friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is mind, creative and reactive. We know that what distinguishes man from an animal is the power to think, power to choose, and self-awareness. And all of these spring from mind. Now, if we look at science, we find that science considers mind to be something immaterial. They call it that it is an epiphenomenon of matter. It is also said that it's the label given or name given to the whole process of the action of the brain in evolving a thought. The whole action of the brain in evolving a thought is what we call as mind. But that means that if there is no brain, there would be no mind. Whereas, according to theosophy, brain is only an instrument of mind. That mind can exist even without brain. Mind is there even without brain. In fact, the brain convolutions, its depth and variety, is not the cause for mind, but in fact they are caused because there is a presence of mind in man. Now, if we look at the world today, you find with the advent of computers and lot of artificial intelligence field coming up, people, even ordinary man, is afraid today that one day these computers will replace man. And these people who deal in artificial intelligence in that field, they have made comparison of the circuitry in the computers and the brain structure. And they found that these electronic circuits work around a million times faster than the firing of neurons in the brain. And so they feel that one day these computer and computer-guided robots will make man superfluous. Now, if we look at this, we find that they have merely compared brain of man with the computers. They are not comparing the mind. Mind is something superior, far superior than the brain. And look at the definition theosophy has of mind. It is the name given to the sum of the states of consciousness grouped under thought, will and feeling. And what is the origin of mind? We are told in theosophy, again, as Mr. Judd says, that if you tell the modern man, he will find this whole idea very far-fetched. When we talk about the origin of man in theosophy, we are told that in the evolution of man, there was a point in time where man was man only in form. He was more or less like an animal with the mind, as we see it functioning today, being only dormant. Like the candle has the potentiality to give light, but it is only potential. Somebody has to light it. Similarly, in man, also this mind was lying dormant. And in the course of evolution, man reached certain state where he acquired the brain, which was far deeper and far greater capacity than that of any other animal. She goes and compares it in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. But even the mind of gorilla, etc., etc., with man, and she says that it's man's brain is far superior than the brain of even the gorillas and the chimpanzees and so on. We won't go into it now. But when that point was reached, we are told that certain divine beings, we call as Manasaputras or the Agnishwata Pitris, they lighted the mind in man. It was like taking a lighted candle and lighting up the unlit candle. The whole process we call as the lighting up of mind. With that, man got the power to think, power to choose, self-awareness, what we call as the I am I consciousness, which stems from mind. However, again, it may sound very mysterious, very different from the view today. We are told that not the whole of this mind is working here and now through man's body. Only a portion of this mind works. Buddhism talks about, therefore, two minds, the relative mind and the absolute mind. Theosophy calls this as the higher mind and the incarnated mind. The mind which works here and now through the body, we call it as incarnated mind. However, this incarnated mind, it can function at various levels. At least three distinct levels we can recognize. When this mind, say, is wrapped up in passions, desires, totally worldly things, emotions, we call this as the kama mind, passional mind, animal mind, or we can also label it as the reactive mind. Now, when this mind is functioning on its own plane, when you are, say, lost in solving a mathematical problem, you are reasoning out, choosing something, making some choice, That is mind on its own level. We call it mind per se. And then the third level is when this mind, sometimes, rarely it happens, when we are listening to the spiritual nature within and we are obeying that spiritual nature within, then it is the divine mind or what we can call as creative mind. Now, we won't go much into detail, but the second quotation in your hand says just this thing. In fact, it just divides into two levels, the higher and the lower. So it says, manas, mind, is dual. Lunar in the lower, solar in its upper portion, says a commentary. That is to say, it is attracted in its higher aspect towards buddhi and in its lower aspect, descends into and listens to the voice of its animal soul, full of selfish and sensual desires, and herein is contained the mystery of an adept's as of a profane man's life. So, we can say the mystery, or rather the distinction, that means the reactive and the creative mind are not two separate minds. It's the same mind functioning on two different levels. Now, one thing we must grasp is that it is not the senses which are the culprit. It is the mind. As Sri Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, that the senses and organs will go towards their appropriate object and they will produce pain and pleasure, cold and heat. These do thou endure, he says. And that means that the senses will only bring in the sense data. Just as you put ice cream on the tip of your tongue, the tongue will only report the sensation that it feels cold, that it feels sweet, but it's the mind which intervenes and says that I like it and I want more of it. So the voice of the silence says that thou shalt not let thy senses make a playground of thy mind. This is the reactive mind. And as we shall see the characteristics of the reactive mind, we will agree that it is the ordinary everyday mind which is functioning in us. For which we can rather say that it is the mind which uses us rather than we using the mind. Because it is, as the name suggests, reactive. It only reacts. It requires an outside stimulus to really set it into motion. And this stimulus is brought by our senses. Whether it is some sight, whether it is something that we hear, and then the mind gets activated. To take a very familiar example, we see while we are passing by a hoarding, or on the TV, an advertisement. There is a beautiful girl displaying a particular brand of soap. There is a handsome man, again, displaying some brand of a cigarette. And immediately there is an impulse to go and buy that brand of soap or cigarette, or we make a mental note of it, or there is already, we are predisposed to buying that brand of cigarette or soap the next time we go to the market. Now, this particular sight has activated the mind. It has set it into motion. The mind has reacted. We have not really done any great thinking. The beautiful girl has just made us think of buying that soap or that brand of cigarette. So in Aldous Huxley, in his book, Ends and Means, says that children should be taught that there is no earthly connection between the beautiful girl in a silk gown and the merits of the toothpaste that she is really displaying. We are just associating in our mind that it's because the beautiful girl is displaying it, the toothpaste will be whatever she is telling it to be. Now, similarly in our relationship with other people, when someone talks harshly to us, what happens? Again, there is reaction. We just hit back. We can say, how dare you, or shut up, or whatever it is. It is reaction. We have not thought about it. Now, so more or less, we behave as if we are programmed. We give set reactions in set situations. In fact, if you look into your own life, you can really multiply examples. The student just thinks of one where you find that sometimes you're talking to an elder and you say that, you're feeling very tired. And they will say, at your age, I used to never get tired. I never kept servants. I used to do all my cooking and I used to cook for 10 people. Always when you tell them this, the reaction is these very sentences. Now, we can also explore our own nature and we find that to a certain set situations, we have set reactions, which a Buddhist author, Sangha Rakshita, calls this as a penny in the slot mind. He says, it's like the machines we have. You put in a coin, out comes the packet. But certain times our reactions are such that people always tell us, I knew you will say that. Why should we be so programmed? Why should we be so definite in our reactions, as if we can't change our minds or work differently? Now, we have these set, therefore, feelings, set modes of thinking also, as again, we have these things like, it is a Marwadi person, then he has to be stingy. If it is a Gujarati, he has to be money-minded. If the person, say, doesn't go to the church or say his prayers, then he is an unreligious person. We have categorized and put people in slots, whereas we need to take a fresh look at the person every time that we meet him. A person we have known to be hot-tempered. You meet him not after 10 days, even after a year or 2 years, at the back of your mind, there is that prejudgment that this person is hot-tempered. Or if he had been caught stealing, then that prejudice is still there, that he is a robber. So, but couldn't he have changed in the course of 1 year, 2 years, 5 years when we meet? Bernard Shaw, very jokingly, he writes that only my tailor measures me afresh every time that I go to him, expecting that there will be some change in my physical measurement. Why can't man's, so also psychic and mental natures also change over the period of time? So this we have to, instead of categorizing in fixed categories, we should always have a fresh look at people. This is what Mr. Judge calls as having grooves in your mind. He gives a beautiful example of the railway engine. That the railway engine has got the wheels which are flanged. These flanged wheels are therefore designed to run on a track of a particular size. Meter gauge, broad gauge, narrow gauge. And he says human minds are like that, having the grooves. And the groove of one man's mind will not run into or be ready to run into the natural groove of another man's mind. But if you take off the flange, you can make the wheel face broader, narrower as you want. So also we can adjust and accommodate our minds to other minds. In other words, instead of giving reaction to someone who say is mean or who say talks angrily with you, there is always this other reaction possible where you can say that, what makes him say the things that he's saying? Is it because of his bringing up? Is it because at the particular moment he's not in a proper frame of mind, he's not feeling well? Similarly, if someone criticizes and says you are proud, instead of feeling very angry, we can always say, let me look at myself. Am I really as proud as he says? Then I can always take measures to remedy myself. So also there need not be the reaction of frustration and despair whenever you say encounter difficulties. There could always be a question, why am I put into this situation? Have I got to learn something out of it? So this is the mind working in a different way. There is deliberation, there is thought, there is analysis, and this we call as at least heading towards having a creative mind, where you don't react, but you respond. When you respond, there is always this kind of analysis, there is always a kind of thinking, instead of just saying or doing the first thing that comes to your mind. That is why H.P. Blavatsky says that we have to learn to act from within rather than reacting to the stimuli from without. Now, having looked at some characteristics of the reactive mind, let us see what is it that constitutes the creative mind. Now, creative mind, as we said, it responds. So there is deliberation, there is thinking, classification, analysis. But, as one can say, that creative mind is the mind which therefore feels love where there is no reason to love. As the Bible, Jesus says in Bible, that what is the merit if you love those who love you? Do not even the publicans the same? That is, it comes very easy to us. They are affectionate to us and we are able to give the same reaction. Again, it is then reaction, although we are loving them. But we know that it involves a certain amount of effort when we are trying to say, love those who are very inimical to us, who are hostile towards us. It is really an act of creation. Similarly, we can say that creative mind is optimistic where there is no reason to be optimistic. here comes the incidents to the student's mind, where maybe it took place, maybe it didn't, but it's about the parents who had twins. One was very pessimistic, the other was very optimistic. Now, as a kind of a therapy suggested by the psychotherapist, they were asked to give these children to both of them on their birthday gifts, such that the pessimist would cheer up a little with the kind of gifts that he gets. So that sort of gifts were to be given. Now the parents buy the appropriate gifts and they are given to these children and they observe their reactions. Now a big box is there and this pessimist, he opens the box and he finds that he's got a computer as a birthday present. And yet when he opens, he sees and begins to grumble at the first instant. He says, oh, but then it's not the same brand as I wanted. It's not the same make as so and so his friend had. The mouse size is like this and the CPU is not vertical and whatever. The other boy was also given a big box. He opens it and the box is full of horse dung. It is full of manure. And still he laughs out loudly and says, they can't fool me. When there is so much of horse dung, there has got to be a pony somewhere. So this is an extreme form of optimism, you can say, but we do come across people in life who, for whom you really feel that what makes them go on. Their situation is so hopeless and yet they are carrying on with some hope that things will change, things will become better. So that is creative mind. See, being optimism where there is no reason to be optimism, be optimistic. And also, if the creative mind is a mind where you feel happiness, joy, calm, where there is no reason to feel happiness, joy and calm. Again, an incident comes. By the way, both these incidences are from the book Chicken Soup for the Soul. You must be all reading that. And there's this other story where it's about two men who are in the hospital. And one was having such a disease where he has to just lie down in the bed all the time. He couldn't even sit up. The other is the man who can sit up for some time and his bed was near the window. Now, as it happens, this man is allowed to sit up for 1 hour. So he looks out of the window and describes what he sees out of the window to this other man in the bed who is not able to get up. From his description, it looks as if there is a park outside with a lake and children playing. So he says that, look, now the children have come to play. They are sailing their paper boats and there are ducks and swans. They are feeding them. And vivid description. Every day for 1 hour, he would do that. And this fellow would feel really joyous for the entire hour when he is describing all this. Now, one fine day, this fellow thinks that, why can't I have that pleasure of seeing myself out of the window instead of he telling me what is going on there? Now, the days pass and we are told that one night, this man who is near the window feels breathless. He was going through some problem in the lungs. And at that point, this man sees him, that he's struggling for breath. He's not able to call the nurse. And yet, he doesn't do anything to help him. The man dies in the morning and he's moved out. And this other person, he then requests after a while that, can I be shifted near the window? And his request is met. Then he looks out. He struggles to sit up. He can't even sit up. He struggles to sit up, looks out of the window, and what does he see? He sees that the window is facing a blank wall. So all the time, this is really an instance of a creative mind. This man was all the time looking on the blank wall and creating such episodes of joy, such episodes of pleasure, not only having himself the happiness, but endowing it upon even this other patient. So this is the mind, which, as it is said, it creates heaven in hell's despair. And that is why it's for nothing that we have these things said by the people when they say that the greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind. Most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. A happy person is not a person in a certain set of circumstances, but rather a person with a certain set of attitudes. So it's all a matter of mind. Now, we said that, so the creative mind, it really creates happiness and joy and peace where there is no occasion for it. Also, we can see this happening in relationship. It is really a creative mind at work. When certain people, when you are with them or when they enter the room, they charge the whole atmosphere with their positive emotions. We say that, oh, his laughter is contagious, his optimism is contagious, and so they are creative in their relationship. Now, at a little higher level, it is this creative mind which is functioning in the artist, the musician, the painter, the author. All of these people are displaying the creative mind. At a still higher level, we are told that this is the creative mind at its best, we can say, in a spiritual being, like a Buddha, like a Shankara. And what is this creative mind? Again, to be a little technical, we already saw there is the higher mind and there is the incarnated mind which is functioning here and now. Whenever this mind which is functioning here and now can become receptive to the higher mind, it is able to display this sort of creativity. Technically, we call it as the conjunction of buddhi with mind, or the incarnated mind becoming one with the higher mind. And these are only the technical terms. In other words, whenever we are able to go a step nearer to our spiritual source, at that time, our mind is a creative mind. Now, here we are in the next quotation, we are given an occult bit of information regarding what is it that enables an artist to accomplish these works of creation. In Raja Yoga or occultism, she says, the higher part of the mind is connected with the spiritual soul or buddhi, the lower with the animal soul, the karma principle. There are persons who never think with the higher faculties of their mind at all. Those who do so are the minority and are beyond the average humankind. These will think even upon ordinary matters on the higher plane. Certainly, it, that is the habit of thinking in the higher mind, can be developed with great difficulty, a firm determination, and through much self-sacrifice. But it is comparatively easy for those who are born with a gift. Why is it that one person sees poetry in a cabbage or a pig with her little ones, while another perceives in the loftiest things only their lowest and most material aspect, will laugh at the music of the spheres and ridicule the most sublime conceptions and philosophies? The difference depends simply on the innate power of the mind to think on the higher or on the lower plane. The person who is endowed with the faculty of thinking about even the most trifling things from the higher plane of thought has, by virtue of that gift which he possesses, a plastic power of formation in his very imagination. Whatever such a person may think about, his thought will be so far more intense than the thought of an ordinary person that by this very intensity it obtains the power of creation. So here we are actually talking about the power of creation. And we often use the word sankalpa very loosely. In fact, it comes from the two roots, sam and kalpa. Sam is thoroughly or completely, and kalpa, from which the word kalpana or imagination comes. It means when we say we made a sankalpa, it ought to be that we have thought it out or imagined it so thoroughly that whatever you think about or imagine actually happens. So that kind of a faculty is possible for the human mind. We again won't go into this creative aspect of this mind much in detail. But so there is this creation. Now, having seen a little bit about the reactive and the creative aspects of mind, naturally we may want to know, how do we convert the reactive mind to creative mind? Now, again, it may sound very surprising, but we can say that we have to learn, first of all, how to think. The student had once come across the article on how to think. And there, rightly, it has been pointed out that you ask anyone suddenly, what was he thinking about? And the reaction would be, nothing in particular, or I don't know, I'm not sure. So, we are not aware at a particular time what were we thinking about. Of course, rarely when you are concentrated and thinking about a definite thing, it's a different matter. But most of the time, we are really taken by surprise. We are not sure, we are not aware of our thought processes. And so, the first thing we need to learn is to observe our thoughts. That in what direction these thoughts are going. Most of the time they are random thoughts. Simply entering the mind and leaving the mind. Thoughts arising merely out of association. To take an example, suppose you feel thirsty and there is a mineral water bottle. Before you drink, you look at the label, it is this brand, but then the thought arises that these days they are using these bottles, but they put the same water, ordinary water inside. So, how safe is it to drink? Oh, what corruption in India. Then corruption in India, corruption in the ministry, corruption in in the office. That reminds you of the confidential report of the subordinate you have to write. That reminds you of, very hardworking, but really corrupt, honest, not very honest. But he's a moldable fellow. So from drinking and the thirst, your mind has traveled at a tangent to your colleague in the office and his confidential report. So this is our thought processes. It's not really under our control, as it were. So you're told that we have to observe. The first step, you go to any this thing, good philosophy, and we are told that the first step is to observe your thinking. And this is very important, because one definite advantage we are told is that suppose you are a hot-tempered person and you observe your thoughts. First, you will become aware only after you have lost your temper. But as you keep up this practice of observing the thoughts, just watch. You will become aware at least a few seconds before you are about to lose your temper. So it is now in your hands whether to give way to your anger or not. So also if we observe our thoughts, there could be all sorts of thoughts which enter of criticism, envy, indifferent thoughts. And to the unwholesome thoughts, we can always say no. And as often we are given this example, that it is your thought entering your mind is like a person knocking at the door. Once you open the door, it's up to you whether to allow that person in or not. Similarly, it's true of your thoughts. You can not lend your energy to the thoughts. They will not inhere. They may arise, but they will fade away because you are not going to say yes to those thoughts. Also, we are told that you can displace these thoughts by positive thoughts, by say thoughts of, suppose it is criticism, you can replace it by thoughts of charity, thoughts of love and something which is quite opposite of what you were thinking about. Then, because the whole idea is that two opposite kinds of thoughts cannot occupy the same plane at the same time. Only one thought can be in your mind at the given time. So, as this is exactly what is there in this book, The Power of Positive Thinking, the very famous book. He is more or less telling the same technique. He says, when the mind is emptied, something is bound to enter. Start filling your mind with creative and healthy thoughts. Then when the old fears, hates, worries have haunted you for so long, try to edge back in. They will in effect find a sign on the door of your mind reading occupied. Because your mind is now occupied with healthy and good thoughts. Now, they may struggle for admission, but the new and healthy thoughts which you have taken in will now be stronger and better fortified and therefore be able to repulse them. And we know that mind, it is compared with water. We know that how water, when you put it in a squared vessel, it appears squared. In a round vessel, it appears rounded. So, as Mr. Jad says, mind becomes that to which it is devoted. Now, it's a very profound statement. Look at what happens. We would have all experienced this sometime or the other, that you are having a birthday party. Then you start thinking about the venue, the menu, the kind of people you will invite, what you will wear. And you just think along those lines all the time. It could be anything else of the similar nature. And we find that as soon as the mind is free from the urgent thing on hand, immediately it goes back to these thoughts of the birthday party and planning about it. Slowly and gradually it happens that you have to say, I can't help thinking about it. Just involuntarily the mind runs in that direction. Now, is this something desirable? Often we compare mind with a horse. And we say that it's good to have a horse because you can reach your destination faster. But what's the use of a horse which is always going to run to the stable, whereas you want to take him, you want him to take you to a certain place. So our mind is like that. we are not able to control it. It just goes in its own direction, taking us with it, as it were. So the Buddha says, it's only the man who is able to control the mind, him I call a real charioteer, others but hold the reins. It's as if you have the mind, but it's only namesake. You have no control over your thoughts. You have no control over your thought processes or mind. Coming to thinking, once again, we've been talking about reactive mind. And it is again the mark of the reactive mind, we can say, where there is no thinking in the real sense of the term. Almost all of us would pride ourselves in saying that we are really thinking creatures. Of course I think all the time, but it is really brought home to us that we are not in the real sense of the word thinking. As again, we shall see what Theosophy has to say a little later. To give an example, which is given in Eric Fromm's book, The Fear of Freedom, he distinguishes between pseudo-thinking and genuine thinking. An example is given that supposing you have a person, he's a fisherman in a town, and you ask him that, what do you think is the weather going to be like in the next 6 hours? And looking at the direction of the wind, looking at the humidity, temperature, he will be able to tell you, predict the weather in the next 6 hours. Now he would have heard the radio forecast also, but he will use the radio forecast only to support his conclusion. He has come to that conclusion through his own thinking. Now take another man who absolutely has no idea of weather prediction. But he thinks that he has answers to all the questions. So when you ask him, what do you think will be the weather like? And he would have heard the radio forecast and he'll simply repeat that. The weather is going to be so and so. Now if you say, how did you reach this conclusion? And in the support, he will say, I looked at the direction of the wind, humidity, temperature is such and such, so I think it is going to be like this. But actually, he has absorbed already the conclusion which was reached by someone else, made it as his own thinking, and just to support it now, he has used rationalizing, that I looked at this and that, and I have come to this conclusion. So most of the time what we do is really that we are accepting what is thought out by other people. If we are ever asked our views on what do you think about the censor in the films, or what do you think about the communal violence, what do you think about nuclear power weapons testing and all that, and we will only rattle out what we have read in a good magazine, a good newspaper, and so on. This also is true regarding our appreciations, our feelings. We are not really using our power of judgment, the power of choice. As again, very often we have given this example from this platform, that again, it is pointed out by Dr. Fromm only, where he says that you take an ordinary man to a art gallery and you show him the paintings. Now, when he looks at these paintings, you ask his judgment. What does he think about them? Now, as he sees the paintings, he also reads the names of the painters. And then, if it is the painting by Van Gogh, if it is painting by Picasso, he'll say, oh, it's a beautiful painting. Now, in the heart of the heart, or if you take him aside and ask, really, did you find it beautiful? He might say, not really. And especially in the modern art today, the student feels that many people, they understand not the head or tail of these splashes of colors and lines, but they will be adorning their walls with these modern art because it is considered to be the thing of the day. It is considered and appreciated by other people. So, in reading books, in appreciating music, or in appreciating paintings, again, we are not using our faculty of mind. We are not using that power of choice where we can say, no, I don't like it. Why can't we say, I don't like it, I don't see anything in this painting? No, but we will say, because it is M.F. Hussain or whatever, we'll say, no, it's a very good painting, and yes, I will buy it or whatever it is. So, there. And similarly, in choosing the careers, in willing, what we can say, which is also an aspect of mind. In willing, where we say, I want this, I want that. Today, or even in our times when we were in the college and school, I want to become an engineer, I want to become a model, I want to become an actor. But at the base, again, if you ask, is it I who wants to become an engineer, doctor, or whatever? No. So, unfortunately, we are judging something beautiful because we are supposed to judge it beautiful. We want something because we are supposed to want it. Now, what does it mean? It means we've got the power of choice. We call ourselves free-willed beings, but we have used that free will to choose those things which has got the sanction of majority of people, something which has got the approval of majority of people, and we dare not go against them. I mean, it's very easy to see. Earlier days, it used to be looked down upon to, say, take the career of a film actress or take part in modeling. And now, because it's considered to be the mark of a high society, prestigious to be a model, we want to become models, we want to become actors, air hostesses. They were called glorified ayahs. But now people, they just fight with each other to become air hostess. Now, this is what we mean by. So we are not using our free will. So we say that we have free will, but again, that power of mind, free will, we are again not making use of. And this is something very important. Before we go a little further, see what Robert Crosby has to say. In a nutshell, he has given this whole thing. He says, from our birth, we are surrounded by those who suggest certain ideas to us as true. And we follow the suggested ideas. There is very little original thought anywhere, and particularly is this true in politics, religion, science. Whatever system of thought is presented to us, we adopt. This power of suggestion must still be used. He is not saying that you should not take into account the suggestions of the people, books and other things. But how should it be? He says, if truth exists and is possible to us, the truth in religion, science and philosophy, it must first come to us by suggestion from those who know. But when the truth is suggested to us, there is always a means presented by which we may see and verify it. That means is not anyone's authority or endorsement, but the fact that we can perceive it and test it for ourselves. The final authority is man himself. So in other words, it's true. We can take into account the ideas, suggestions, opinions which are there around us. After all, somebody has done a lot of thinking. But before accepting it, we didn't gobble it up. We have to have the final authority is the man himself. And this is something very important in spiritual life. In Light on the Path, we are told that in order to develop that faculty of intuition, the man has to be untamable. He has to play the lord over man, things, people, save his own divinity. That is, you will hear there are 1001 voices impinging on your mind and ears. But that doesn't mean that we have to follow these voices. A time can come when we have to defy the voice of authority. We have to defy the voice of your religious authority, religion, scientific authority, maybe your pressure of the peer pressure, as they say, that social groups, everything provided. Honestly, if you have consulted your own higher nature, your own spiritual nature, and if that says do this, then we should feel bold enough to do and take that particular course of action. As we've again said this many times from this platform, that when Saint Joan, when she was put before the church, and she was not really with many, many things which were said by church, and church authorities, they asked, do you dare to set your judgment against that of the church? And she said, by what other judgment could I judge? What other judgment is there but man's own judgment? And that own judgment, it comes from our own higher nature. In the process, we will make mistakes. In the beginning, we may even go wrong in the choices that we have made. But finally, slowly and surely, we are led in the direction, because it is that voice, which is the voice of our higher nature, which without having to, say, rationalize, going through these processes of premises to conclusion, at one go we are able to see what is right and what is wrong, what is permanent, what is impermanent. That is that voice of conscience, voice of intuition, whatever you call it. Now, in this process, the next quotation we are not reading, but the next one says that the seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breadth and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. Seek not those points in Maya's realm, but soar beyond illusions. Search for the eternal and the changeless Sat, mistrusting fancies, false suggestions. This is from the Mahayana Buddhist text, Voice of the Silence. Again, just in few lines, we are given the whole technique. That how can we make our mind receptive to this higher nature, the voice of the higher nature? And we are told first we have to acquire the breadth of mind. Even the most educated person today is at best what they used to call as kupamanduk, the frog in the well. You can't see beyond the circular edge of the wall. You may know everything about the field in which you are working or the education you have taken. But how much do we know about the knowledge we have regarding other fields, other faculties? There is so much. So the first thing is breadth of mind, increasing your awareness, getting as much knowledge as you can. That will give you intellectual breadth. But even then, we know that even the most intelligent man today, the most educated man today, when it comes to religion, he is suddenly very narrow-minded. He will be a Hindu and he'll say, how can you go to the mosque? How can you read Bible? How can you read Quran? So, or marrying one's daughter to outside the caste. Now these things, it is still your mind is narrow. So that is what is required is cultural, religious, moral breadth of mind. And again, that requires that we need to be appreciative and tolerant of other religions. We need to be appreciative and tolerant of other people's ways of celebrating their festivals, celebrating their ways of dressing up, mannerisms, so on and so forth. And also, the breadth of mind can come from universal ideas, reading of scriptures, reading lives of great people. And when you read, you've got to be attentive. As they say, you have to be alert, awake, discriminating. Not gobble up because the author says, but nor should you reject it just because it doesn't gel well with your ideas which you hold. That, the very fact that you are willing to consider, even when you don't agree with the author, is a step in the direction of getting the breadth of mind. That's why there is the Narada saying put at the end of the first volume of Isis Unveiled, where he says that never utter these words. I do not know this, so it cannot be. For one must study to know to understand, and understand to judge. So this breadth of mind, whether we are dealing with people, whether we are dealing with views in whatever field it is, this breadth. Then is the depth of mind. Going deeper and deeper into the subject, asking why of everything, why it is so. Also having a kindly concern for your opponent. Why does he feel the way he does? It may sound like a very silly belief of his, very silly opinion. But maybe there is a grain of truth in what he says. So this willingness to accept truth from whatever quarter it comes, as H.P.B. says. And the depth also comes when we are not ready to be satisfied with the first thing that you come across. That in reading the scriptures, you are not satisfied with its surface meaning. You try to dig deep and see that what is the occult meaning. Try to read between the lines. So this is the depth of mind. In fact, it's a very large subject we are just cramping into the few minutes. And there is something like points to draw it towards a dinosaur. Now again, it may sound surprising, but for having this intuition or this wisdom which is there in our higher mind to flower forth, what is required is what is known as the heart quality of mind. As it is said that it is not enough to have an intelligent mind and a compassionate heart, but also to have a compassionate mind and an intelligent heart. So that there has to be concern for people around. There has to be readiness to help the people around. And in this, all the time we got to be ready to listen to that small voice which is always guiding us. In the last quotation, that is what we are told. That if sometimes you're told from within to go and visit a sick person, to go and help a person, then you should not sit and calculate, oh, but then I have got this other work to do that will suffer, or in giving money to the beggar, but how do I know he might go and take a drink out of that money? If that genuinely good impulse has come to help, then you must obey that impulse. And then we are told that this voice will speak louder and louder in you, more and more clearly. So we'll just end with this quotation, which says, every impulse from above, every prompting of the divine within, should meet at once with hearty welcome and response. If some pathetic story of suffering has moved you, act on the emotion while your cheeks are still wet with tears. In short, put yourself at once in line with divine ways, in harmony with divine laws, more light, more wisdom, more spirituality must necessarily come to one thus prepared, thus expectant. Friends, we've got few minutes left for questions on the subject. This is a little technical question. The student, for the sake of simplification, was talking in terms of higher mind and lower mind. In our philosophy, we are told that there is only one mind. We label it as higher mind and lower mind because there is this technicality behind it. That there is this mind. We talked about the process of lighting up of manas, which endowed man with the power to think and choose and self-awareness. But this mind, we are told that in given life, the whole of the potentiality of the mind doesn't come into play. And it is said, therefore, just in order to be able to make it simple for us to understand, it is said that a ray of the mind is sent to work through a given personality or to work through a given body, and we call this as an incarnated mind. And what is the mind, which we call as higher mind, is that mind which remains on its own plane. Unless and until this ray, or the portion of the mind which is working or functioning here and now through the body, unless and until it turns for its guidance to this, what we call as higher mind, it will not be able to help. So it's more or less, we can understand, it's more or less like an ambassador sent to another country. That you send a person from India to America as an ambassador to that country. And he is only a representative to our country. And he can, of course, in the course of his stay, forget all about his original or parent country, get totally Americanized over there. He may not even represent the country well. Something like that happens to our country.